anemic rod or a stubby wand poked out of a holster. Several pouches were fastened closed and looked as though they would contain bits and pieces of the standard wizarding gear I habitually carried with me when I was working. He also bore a long white staff, a simple wooden pole made of an unfamiliar wood. I stared at him for a moment, then I said, "The peace talks are over?" "Of course not," the Merlin said. "Goodness, Dresden. We aren't going to allow the entire senior council to stand on a stage within reach of a vampire's claws. Are you mad?" I blinked at him. "Wizard McCoy was the only actual senior council member on the stage," he said, and then grimaced. "Aside from Christos, of course, who is unaware of the security measure. The envoy might well be an assassin." I worked my jaw a few times and said, "So you left him up there by himself while you played it safe?" The Merlin shrugged. "One of us had to be there to handle any questions. It was McCoy's idea, Dresden. He is an irritating, arrogant, and formidable man." I scowled and mentally flogged my brain for slacking, forcing myself to see past my emotionally driven, hostile response. "You don't trust the vampires," I said slowly. "You aren't drinking the Kool-Aid on this peace conference." Langtree looked at me patiently, then he looked at Lucio. "Johnstown," she provided. "The mass suicide last century." He frowned at that and then nodded. "Ah, I see the metaphor. No, Dresden, we are not willing to simply accept them at their word. But a great many people on the council do not concur. Christos has garnered an enormous number of supporters who very much want to embrace the terms of peace." "If you don't want to call off the war," I said, "then why the hell did you stop me, Captain Lucio? I could have fixed it for you right there." "You wouldn't have," Langtree said calmly. "You would have been knocked senseless and thrown in a hole." A faint smile touched his lips as he spoke the words. "Granted, a pleasant notion, but not a practical one." Next to me, Molly put her elbows on the table and propped up her chin in her hands, staring at the Merlin thoughtfully. My brain kept chugging. "I think I can, I think I can." When it got to the top of the hill, my eyes widened. "You aren't planning to smoke the peace pipe. You're expecting an attack." He looked at me blandly and rested one hand on the hilt of his combat wand, as if by pure coincidence. "Egad, what gave it away, Dresden?" I started to say something hot in reply, Merlin or no Merlin, but Anastasia put a hand on my wrist. "Our sources," she said, overriding my incipient insult, "have reported a great deal of activity in the Red Court camp. They're mobilizing." I looked back and forth between them. "You figure they're trying a Trojan horse?" "Or some variant thereof," Langtree replied. "So we're getting ready for it," Anastasia said, "as well as preparing the heaviest counterattack we've thrown at them yet." Molly said, "what if they're serious about making peace?" Everyone looked at her, and my apprentice visibly wilted beneath the Merlin's gaze. "It might happen," she said. Langtree smiled faintly. "The leopard cannot change his spots, Miss Carpenter. Sheep can befriend the hungry wolf only briefly. The Red Court is all savagery and crocodile tears. If they make peace, it is only because they need the time to replenish themselves before fighting anew." "Really old things get set in their ways," I confirmed to Molly, my tone, including Langtree, as a matter of course. "Always hope for the best and prepare for the worst." Molly chewed her lip thoughtfully and nodded. Langtree eyed me and said, "Need I explain why I have explained, Dresden?" "Maybe you'd better," I said. "I mean, you didn't use illustrations or anything, Professor." Langtree inhaled, briefly closed his eyes, and then looked away from me. Molly said, frowning. "We want the Red Court to attack, if that's their intention," I told her. "We want the Red Court to think their trick is working. We want them to be overconfident. Then, when they hit us, we hit them back so hard and fast that they don't know what's coming until it's over." No, Langtree said. So they never knew it was coming, period. We will no longer wage a war with that filth, cold, hot, or otherwise. We're going to destroy them, root and branch. He lifted his chin slightly as his voice turned to frost. We're going to exterminate them. Silence followed. The fire crackled cheerfully. I felt my hands clench into fists. But you need them to expose themselves first, and that, I whispered, is why you're going to ask me to lay off Duchess Ariana. Don't be absurd, Langtree said in a calm, quiet voice. I'm not asking you. I am ordering you to desist, Warden Dresden. And let the child die, I said. In all probability, the child is already dead, or else turned, Langtree said. And even if she still survives, we must face a cold truth. Uncounted billions now living and yet to be born will be saved if we stop the Red Court from feeding on humanity ever again. His voice became even colder. No one life, innocent or not, is worth more than that. I said nothing for several long, silent seconds. Then I stood up. I faced the Merlin for a moment. I could feel the obdurate adamant will that drove the man, and made his power the greatest well of mortal magic on the face of the earth. You've got it backward, you know, I told him quietly. No life is worth more than that. No, Merlin. No life is worth less. His expression never changed, but his fingers tightened slightly on his staff. His cold blue eyes touched lightly upon Molly, and then returned to me. The threat was plain to see. I leaned over close to his ear and whispered, Go ahead, Arthur. Try it. Then I straightened slowly away, letting every emotion and every thought drain out of my expression. The tension in the air was thick. No one moved. I could see Molly trembling where she sat. I nodded slowly at the Merlin. Then I said in a quiet, clear voice, Grasshopper. Molly stood up immediately. I kept myself between the girl and Langtree as we walked to the door. He didn't offer any challenge, but his eyes were arctic and absolute. Behind him, Lucio gave me a single, tiny, conspiratorial nod. Hell's bells. She'd known who she would be working against all along. Molly and I left Edinburgh behind and headed back home to Chicago. Chapter 9. I watched out for trouble all the way back to Chicago, but it didn't show up. The trip from Edinburgh would be a difficult one if limited by strictly physical means of transport. Wizards and jet planes go together like tornadoes and trailer parks, and with similarly disastrous results. Boats are probably the surest means of modern transport available to us, but it's a bit of a ride from Scotland to Chicago. So, we do what a good wizard always does when the odds are stacked up against us. We cheat. The Never-Never, the spirit world, exists alongside our own, sort of like an alternate dimension. But it isn't shaped the same way as the mortal world. The Never-Never touches upon places in the mortal world that have something in common with it, a resonance of energies. So, if Point A is a dark and spooky place in the Never-Never, it touches upon a dark and spooky place in the real world. Let's say the stacks at the University of Chicago. But the space 5 feet away from Point A in the Never-Never, Point B, is only dark and sad, not really scary. Maybe Point B attaches to a cemetery in Seattle. If you're a wizard, you could then start at the stacks at UC, open a doorway into the Never-Never, walk 5 feet, open another doorway back to the real world, and emerge into the cemetery in Seattle. Total linear distance walked, 5 or 6 feet. Total distance traveled, better than 1,700 miles. Neat, huh? Granted, it's almost never as little as 5 feet you walk in the Never-Never, and that stroll just might introduce you to some gargantuan, tentacular horror so hideous that it drives you insane just by looking at it. The Never-Never is a scary place. You don't want to go exploring without a whole lot of planning and backup, but if you know the safe paths, the ways, then you can get a lot of traveling done, nice and quick, and with a minimum incidence of spontaneous insanity. Once upon a time, I would have refused even to enter the Never-Never, except in the direst of emergencies. Now, the idea wasn't much more stressful to me than the thought of hitting a bus station. Things change. We were back in Chicago before lunchtime, emerging from the Never-Never into an alley behind a big old building that used to be a slaughterhouse. I'd parked the Blue Beetle, my beat-up old Volkswagen Bug, nearby. We went back to my apartment. Susan and Martin were waiting. About 2 minutes after we got back, there was a knock at the door, and I opened it to find both half-vampires standing on my doorstep. Martin carried a leather valise on a sling over his shoulder. "Who is the girl?" Martin asked, his eyes calm and focused past me on Molly. "It's nice to see you again, too, man," I said. "And don't mention it. I save people's lives all the time." Susan smiled at me, giving Molly the female once-over, a process by which one woman creates a detailed profile of another woman based upon about a million subtle details of clothing, jewelry, makeup, and body type, and then decides how much of a social threat she might be. Men have a parallel process, but it's binary. Does he have beer? If yes, will he share with me? "Harry," Susan said, kissing me on the cheek. I felt like a pine tree in cougar country. I'd just have to hope territorial scoring of my bark wasn't next. "Who is this?" "My apprentice, Molly Carpenter," I said. "Grasshopper, this is Susan Rodriguez. That's Marvin someone or other." "Martin," he corrected me, unruffled, as he entered. "Can she be trusted?" "Every bit as much as you trust me," I said. "Well," Martin's voice couldn't have been any drier, but he tried. "Thank goodness for that." "I know who they are, Harry," Molly said quietly. "They're from the Fellowship of St. Giles, right? Vampire hunters?" "Close enough," Susan said, standing right next to me, well inside my personal space perimeter. It was an intimate distance. She touched my arm for a moment with fever-hot fingers, but never looked away from Molly. "An apprentice wizard? Really? What's it like?" Molly shrugged, averting her eyes, frowning slightly. "A lot of reading, a lot of boring practice, with occasional flashes of pure terror." Susan looked from Molly to me and seemed to come to some sort of conclusion. She drifted out of my personal space again. "Did you speak to the council?" "A bit," I said. "The Duchess was at headquarters. Spoke to her, too." Susan drew in a sharp breath. "What? She hasn't left Mexico in more than 180 years. "Call Guinness. She broke her streak." "Good God," she said. "What was she doing there?" "Being compassionate and understanding and forgiving me for challenging her to a duel in front of about 1,000 fellow wizards." Martin made a choking sound. Susan's eyes looked a little wide. "I wanted a piece of her right there," I said. "But she was operating under a pledge of safe conduct. Council intelligence says there's all kinds of vampire activity starting up. I've got feelers out for any other word, but it will take a little time." "We already knew about the mobilization," Susan said. "The Fellowship warned the council 3 days ago. "Nice of the council to inform everybody, I guess. But I'll get whatever else the council knows in the next few hours," I said. "You guys turn up anything?" "Sort of," Susan said. "Come on." We went to the seating around the coffee table, and Martin plopped the valise down onto its surface. He drew out a manila folder and passed it to me. "Out of nearly a petabyte of information," he began. "Peta what?" I asked. 1 quadrillion bytes, he clarified, helpfully. Susan rolled her eyes and said, "Several libraries worth of information." "Oh, okay." Martin cleared his throat and continued as if he hadn't been interrupted. "We retrieved fewer than 300 files. Most of them were inventory records. I opened the folder and found several sheets of printer paper covered with lists, and several more that consisted of photographs of any number of objects accompanied by identification numbers. The objects in this file, Susan said, were all categorized as metacapacitors. I grunted, paging through the photos more slowly. A stone knife, an ancient notched sword, a soot-stained brick, an urn covered in odd, vaguely unsettling abstract designs. Yeah, can't be sure without physically examining it, but this stuff looks like ritual gear. I frowned and started cross-referencing numbers on the lists. And according to this, they were all checked out of a secure holding facility in Nevada and shipped as a lot. I glanced up at Susan. When was Maggie taken, exactly? A little less than 24 hours before I called you. I frowned at the timing. They shipped it the same day Maggie was taken. Yes, she said. About 3 hours after the kidnapping. Shipped where? That's the question, she said. Assuming it's connected with Maggie at all.
Odds are that it isn't, Martin said.
Yeah. Your time would be better employed running down all those other leads we have, Marvin. I spared him a glower and went back to studying the pages.
If I can figure out what this gear is used for, maybe I can rule it out. For all I know, it's meant for a rain dance.
I tapped the pages on my knee thoughtfully. I'll do that first. While I do, Molly, I want you to go talk with Father Forthill, personally. We have to assume the phones aren't safe. Forthill has some contacts down south. Tell him I'd like to know if any of them have reported anything unusual. Take Mouse to watch your back.
I can look after myself, Harry. It's still daylight.
Your weapons, Grasshopper,
I said in my Yoda voice.
You will not need them.
She frowned at me in annoyance and said, You know, I believe it is possible to reference something other than Star Wars, boss. I narrowed my eyes in Muppetly wisdom.
That is why you fail.
That doesn't even... Ugh, it's easier just to do it. She stood up and held out her hand. I tossed her the keys to the Blue Beetle. Come on, Mouse. Mouse rose from his position in the kitchen and shambled to Molly's side. Hold up a second, kid. Susan, I said, something about this is making the back of my neck itch. The bad guys knew where to find us last night. They must have some kind of tail on one of us, and we don't need to walk around with a target painted on our backs. Maybe you and Martin could go see if you can catch our shadow.
They'll see us and pull a fade as soon as we leave the apartment, Martin said.
Oh, Molly said abruptly, her eyes brightening. Right.
I went out to get the mail and walk the dog around the little backyard while Molly, Susan, and Martin, under cover of one of Molly's first-class veils, slipped out of the apartment. I gave Mouse 5 minutes, then called him and went back down into the apartment. Molly had beaten me back inside after walking Susan and Martin out of the line of sight of any observers who had a line of sight to my apartment's door.
How was that?
She asked. She tried for casual, but by now I knew her well enough to spot when my answer mattered. Smooth, I said. Did me proud. She nodded, but there was a little bit too much energy in it to be offhand agreement. Hell's bells. I remembered what she was feeling. Wanting so badly to prove my talent, my discipline, my skill, myself to a teacher. It took me nearly a decade for my hindsight to come into focus and to realize how inexperienced, how foolish, and how lucky I had been to survive my apprenticeship with both eyes and all my fingers intact. I wasn't too worried about sending the kid on a solo mission. It was pretty tame, and Forthill liked her. Molly wasn't much in a fight, but she could avoid the hell out of them if she had an instant's warning, which was where Mouse came in. Very little escaped the big dog's solemn notice. If hostility loomed, Mouse would warn her, and hey, presto, they would both be gone. She'd be fine. Don't take too long, I said quietly. Eyes open. Play it safe. She beamed, her eyes alight. You aren't the boss of me. I could all but taste the pride she felt at making her talents useful to my cause. The hell I'm not, I told her. Do it, or I dock you a year's pay. You know you don't pay me anything, right? Curses, I said, foiled again. She flashed me another smile and hurried out, bouncing eagerly up the steps.
Mouse followed close on her heels, his ears cocked alertly up, his demeanor serious. He grabbed his leather lead from the little table by the door as he went by. Molly had forgotten it, but there were leash laws in town. I suspected that Mouse didn't care about the law. My theory was that he insisted on his lead because people were more inclined to feel comfortable and friendly toward a huge dog when he was safely restrained. Unlike me, he's a people person. Canine, whatever. I waited until the beetle had started and pulled out to close the door. Then I picked up Martin's printed pages, tugged aside the rug that covered the trapdoor in the living room floor, and descended into my laboratory. "My laboratory," I said experimentally, drawing out each syllable. Why is it that saying it like that makes me always want to follow it with "mwahahahaha"? "You were overexposed to Hammer films as a child," chirped a cheerful voice from below. I got to the bottom of the stepladder, murmured a word, and swept my hand in a broad gesture. A dozen candles flickered to life. My lab wasn't fancy. It was a concrete box, the building's sub-basement. Someone probably had neglected to backfill it with gravel and earth when the house was built. Tables and shelves lined the walls, covered in wizardly bric-a-brac. A long table ran down the middle of the room, almost entirely occupied by a scale model of downtown Chicago, made of pewter, right down to the streetlights and trees. My apprentice had a workstation at a tiny desk between two of the tables. Though she had continued to add more and more of her own notes, tools, and materials as her training continued, somehow she had kept the same amount of space open. Everything was neatly organized and sparkling clean. The division between Molly's work area and the rest of the room was as sharp and obvious as the lines on a map. I'd upgraded my summoning circle, which was set in the concrete floor at the far end of the little room, a 5-foot hoop of braided copper, silver, and iron that had set me back 3 grand when I ordered it from a Svartalf silversmith. The materials weren't all that expensive, but it took serious compensation to convince a Svartalf to work with iron. Each metal strand in the circle's braid was inscribed with sigils and runes in formulae that harnessed and controlled magical energies to a far greater degree than any simple circle. Each strand had its own string of symbols, work so tiny and precise that only Svartalfs and maybe Intel could have pulled it off. Flickers of light, like static discharge but more liquid, slithered around each strand of metal. Red light, blue, and green, dancing and intertwining in continuous spirals. I'm still young for a wizard, but once in a while, I can make something that's fairly cool. One shelf was different from all the others in the room. It was a simple wooden plank. Volcanic mounds of melted candle wax capped either end. In the center of the shelf was a human skull, surrounded by paperback romance novels. As I watched, orange flickering light kindled in the skull's empty eye sockets, then swiveled to focus on me. "Too many Hammer films," Bob the Skull repeated. "Or, possibly, one too many nights at the Rocky Horror Picture Show." "Janet, Brad, Rocky, ugh," I said dutifully. I went to the shelf, picked the skull up off of it. "Whee," said Bob, and then carried it over to a mostly clean space on one of the work tables. I set the skull down on top of a stack of notebooks and then put Martin's manila folder down in front of him. "Need your take on something," I said. I opened up the folder and started laying out the photographs Martin had given me. Bob regarded them for a moment and asked, "What are we looking at here?" "Metacapacitors," I said. "That's weird, 'cause they look like a bunch of ritual objects." "Yeah, I figure metacapacitor is code language for ritual object." Bob studied the pictures and muttered to himself under his breath. He isn't actually a talking skull. He's a spirit of intellect who happens to reside inside a specially enchanted skull. He's been assisting wizards since the Dark Ages, and if he hasn't forgotten more than I ever knew about the wide world of magic, it's only because he doesn't forget anything. Ever. "They're traveling in a single group. I need to get a ballpark estimate on what they might be used for." "Tough to tell from 2-dimensional images," Bob said.
I start getting confused when there are any fewer than four dimensions. He rattled the skull's teeth together a few times, thoughtfully. Is there anything else? Descriptions or anything? I opened the folder.
Just the inventory list.
I put my finger on the picture of the stone knife and read, Flint Blade. I touched an old brick with crumbling edges.
Brick.
Well, that's just blindingly useful, Bob muttered.
I grunted. It's possible that this is just miscellaneous junk. If you don't think it has a specific purpose, then...
I didn't say that, Bob interrupted sourly.
Jeez, Harry, ye of little faith.
Can you tell me anything or not?
I can tell you that you're teetering on the edge of sanity, Sahib.
I blinked at that.
What?
Bob didn't look up from the pictures.
Your aura is all screwed up. It's like looking at an exploding paint factory. Crazy people get that way.
I grunted and considered Bob's words for a moment. Then I shrugged. I'm too close to this case, maybe.
You need some time in a quiet place, boss. Unkink your brain's dew. Mellow your vibe.
Thank you, Dr. Fraud, I said. I'll take that under advisement. Can you tell me anything about those objects or what?
Not without getting to examine them, Bob said.
I grunted. Super. Another bad inning for the wizard gumshoe.
Sorry, he said, but all I can tell you from here is the trigger.
I frowned. What do you mean?
Oh, those are objects of dark, dangerous magic, Bob said. I mean, obviously. Look at the angles. Nothing is proportional and balanced. They're meant for something destructive, disruptive, dangerous.
I grunted. That tracks. Rumor has it that the war is going to rev up again soon. I ran my fingers tiredly through my hair.
What did you say the trigger was again? For something this dark, Bob asked. Only one thing will do.
I felt myself freeze. My coffeeless gorge began to rise.
Human sacrifice, the skull chirped brightly. The slaughter of an innocent.
Chapter 10. I leaned on a table with my eyes closed. The Red Court was preparing a destructive act of high black magic. The ritual, whatever it was, required a human sacrifice to succeed. In my head, I watched a movie of Maggie being bled out like a slaughtered sheep within a ritual circle, surrounded by an army of vampires beneath a nightmare sky. There was a hideous elegance in it. In a single stroke, my daughter would die, and her death would be used to lash out against the council. It was bald guesswork, but it fit what I'd seen of the Duchess. She could inflict the maximum amount of personal agony on me and launch a sorcerous attack simultaneously. Revenge and war would both be served, all while she smiled and offered promises of peace and understanding, protected from me by the same idiots she was plotting to destroy. I could try to warn them, but few would listen. Ebenezer, maybe, and Anastasia, and some of the young wardens. But even if they listened and believed, they would still have to convince others. The freaking council never does anything quickly, and I had a bad feeling that Tempus was fugiting furiously. So, I just have to do it myself. But to do that, I needed information. I looked at my summoning circle again and took a slow, deep breath. There were things I could do, horrible things. There were beings I could call up, malicious mavens and entities of wicked wisdom who might make the unknowable as plain as daylight. If I did, there would be a terrible price. I tore my eyes from the circle and shook my head. I wasn't that desperate. Yet. Someone knocked loudly on my apartment door. I went upstairs, closed the lab, and picked up my blasting rod. I carried it to the door and looked out the peephole. Murphy stood outside, her hands in her coat pockets, her shoulders hunched.
"Couldn't use the phone," she said when I opened the door. She stepped in and I closed it behind her.
"Yeah, we figure the Red Court might be tapping them."
She shook her head.
"I don't know about that, Harry, but Internal Affairs has got mine wired."
I blinked at her.
"Those IA idiots? Again? Can't Rudolph just let it rest?" Rudolph, the brown-nosed cop cop, as he was affectionately known at SI, had managed to kiss enough ass to escape SI and get reassigned to IA. He seemed to hold a grudge against his former co-workers, irrationally blaming them for his now-concluded exile among them.
"Apparently not," Murphy said. "He's making quite a name for himself over there."
"Murph, you're a good cop. I'm sure that..." She slashed a hand at the air and shook her head.
"That's not important right now. Listen, okay?"
I frowned and nodded at her.
"There's a full-scale investigation going into the bombing of your office building," Murphy said. "Rudolph talked to the lead FBI agent and the local lead detective in charge of the case and convinced them that you're a suspicious character and good perpetrator material." I groaned. "Forensics will bear them out. The explosives were on my floor, some of them in the walls of my office."
Murphy pushed her hair back with one hand. The bags beneath her eyes had grown visibly darker.
"They're going to bring you in and question you in the next couple of hours. They'll probably hold you for the full 24, more if they can find a charge to stick you with."
"I don't have time for that," I said.
"Then you've got to get scarce," Murphy said, "and I've got to go. Neither of us will be helped if we're seen together."
"Son of a bitch," I snarled.
"I am going to throw Rudolph halfway across Lake Michigan and see if the slimy little turd floats."
"I'll bring the lead weights," Murphy said. She drew the amulet I'd made to let her past my apartment's magical defenses from her shirt and showed it to me.
"Hopefully, I won't be able to find you. Get in touch with me when you need my help, huh?"
"Murph," I said, "if the authorities are getting set to come down on me, you can't be around." Her eyebrows climbed a tiny fraction. It was a danger signal.
"Excuse me?" she said politely.
"It's already going to look bad enough. We've worked together so much. If you're actually abetting me now, they won't let you keep your badge. You know they won't. And they might even do more than that. You could wind up in jail."
The subliminal angry tension in her abruptly vanished.
"God, Dresden, you are a simp." I blinked at her.
"If I go with you," she said, "I could wind up in the ground. That didn't seem to worry you."
"Well," I said, I
choose my battles, Dresden, not you." She looked up at me calmly. "Let me put this in terms that will get through your skull. My friend is going to save a child from monsters. I'm going with him. That's what friends do, Harry."
I nodded and was silent for several seconds. Then I said, "I know you, Karen. For you, dying in a good fight would not be a terrible end. You've known it was possible, and you've prepared yourself for it." I took a deep breath. "But if they took your shield away, I know what your job means to you. You'd die by inches. I don't think I could handle watching that happen."
"So you get to choose to shut me out? What I want doesn't count?"
"I don't know," I said. "Maybe."
"And you're the one who decides?"
I thought about it for a moment. Then I said, "No."
She nodded. "Good answer."
She touched her fingertips to the shape of her amulet under her t-shirt. "Call."
"I will. Maybe by messenger, but I will."
"It's occurred to me that someone who wanted to make you suffer might start pulling the trigger on your friends. How do I verify the message?"
I shook my head. The more I thought about it, the more I was sure that even here, in my own home, I couldn't be too careful about being overheard. My apartment was blanketed in protective magic, but there were plenty of people, and not people, who were stronger, more experienced, or wilier than me. If I have to send a messenger, I'll make sure you know who it's from.
Murphy watched me answer. Then she glanced slowly around the room, as if looking for an unseen observer, and nodded her understanding.
"All right. Don't stay here long, Harry."
"Yeah," I said.
"Don't worry about me, Murph."
She made a face.
"I'm not worried about just you. You've got at least one gun stashed here, and I'm betting there's more illegal material in the lab. If they like you for a suspect, they'll get a warrant. And the FBI, as far as I know, doesn't have any amulets to get them in here alive."
I groaned aloud. Murph was right. I had a couple of illegal weapons in my apartment. The swords were still in the lab, too. plus some miscellaneous material that the government probably wouldn't want me owning, including depleted uranium dust for when the answer to who you gonna call turns out to be Harry Dresden. The wards that protected my apartment were going to be an issue as well. They wouldn't do anything if someone walked up and knocked on the door, or even if they fiddled with the doorknob. But anyone who tried to force the door open was in for a shock. About 70,000 volts of shock, in fact, thanks to the defenses I put in place around my door. The lightning was savage, but it was only the first layer of the defense. It hadn't been so terribly long since an army of zombies tore their way into my living room, and I wasn't going to repeat the experience. But my wards wouldn't have any way of differentiating between a zombie or a crazed vampire or a misguided FBI agent. They simply reacted to someone forcing his way inside. I'd have to deactivate the wards before someone got hurt. Then I'd have to remove any suspect gear from the house. Hell's bells. Like I didn't have enough on my mind. I rubbed my thumb against the spot between my eyebrows where the headache was forming. I did not need this on top of everything else. Which is why she did it. Why, who did what? Duchess Ariana of the Red Court, I said. I filled Murphy in on my day. That's out of character, isn't it? Murphy asked. I mean, for them to do something this obtrusive, blowing up a building? They did similar things several times during the war, I said. She was making a statement, blowing up my place of business right in front of God and everybody, the same way the wizards took out her husband's command post in Honduras. Plus, she's diverting my attention and energy, yanking more potential support out from under me. Murphy shook her head. She's so clever, she's making a mistake. Yeah? Yeah. If she was all that smart, she would have blown you to pieces in your office. I nodded. Yeah, that's the most practical way. So why didn't she? Figure she wants to inflict the maximum amount of pain she can before she gets rid of me. Murphy lifted her eyebrows. For vengeance? That's kind of like a bad movie script, isn't it? She put on a faint British accent. No, Mr. Dresden, I expect you to die. I grunted. Murphy had a point. Duchess Ariana almost couldn't have been the sort to enjoy indulging her sadistic side at the expense of practicality. You don't survive millennia as a vampire without being deadly cold-blooded. Which meant... There's something else at work here, I said. Some other game going on. Murphy nodded. How sure are you that Susan is being straight with you? Pretty sure, I said. It sounded a little hollow, even to me. Murphy's mouth twisted up into a bitter curl. That's what I thought. You loved her. Makes it easy to manipulate you. Susan wouldn't do that, I said. I hope not, Murphy replied. But she's been gone a while, Harry. Fighting a war, from the sounds of it. That's enough to change anyone, and not for the better. I shook my head slowly and said, Not Susan. Murphy shrugged. Harry, I've got a bad feeling that... She scrunched up her nose, choosing her words. I've got a bad feeling that the wheels are about to come off. What do you mean? She shrugged. Just the building blowing up is all over the news. You can't find an anchor talking about anything else. People are screaming about terrorists. The whole situation is gaining massive attention from higher up in the government than anything else I've ever seen. You say that most of the White Council has been effectively placed under the control of this Christos person. Now the upper ranks of the Red Court are getting involved, too. And from what you tell me, everyone is reaching for their guns. She spread her hands. It's like the Cuban Missile Crisis. Everyone's at the edge. Hell's bells. Murphy was right. The supernatural world was standing at the edge, and it was one hell of a long way down to the War of Annihilation at the bottom. I took a slow breath, thinking. Then I said, I don't care about that. Murphy's golden eyebrows went up. I'm not responsible for everyone else in the world, Murph. I'm going to find a little girl and take her somewhere safe. That's all. The rest of the world can manage without me. What if that's the last straw, Harry? The little girl?
What will you do then?
I growled as a column of pure rage rose up my spine and made my voice rough. I will make Maggie safe. If the world burns because of that, then so be it. Me and the kid will roast some marshmallows. Murphy watched me thoughtfully for several empty seconds. Then she said, very gently, "You're a good man, Harry." I swallowed and bowed my head, made humble by the tone of her voice and the expression on her face, more than the words themselves.
"Not always rational," she said, smiling, "but you're the best kind of crazy."
"Thank you, Karen." She reached out and squeezed my arm once. "I should go. Call me." "I will."
She left a moment later, and I began sanitizing my apartment for government scrutiny. It would take me a little precious time, but being locked in a cage would take even more. I was still tucking away the last of my contraband when there was a knock at the door. I froze. After a moment, the knock was repeated.
"Harry Dresden," called a man's voice. "This is Special Agent Tilly of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I have a warrant to search this property and detain its occupants for questioning regarding last night's explosion. If you do not open this door, we will be forced to break it down."
Crap.
Chapter 11. I tore the rug from the trap door again. I packed almost all of my questionable materials into a large nylon gym bag. I slung it over my shoulder, grabbed my duster, staff, and blasting rod, and nearly killed myself trying to go down the ladder too quickly. I stopped a couple of steps from the bottom and reached up to close the trap door again. There was a pair of simple bolts on the lower side of the door, so that I or the grasshopper could signal the other that something delicate was in progress and distractions might be dangerous. I locked the door down firmly.
"What's going on?" blurted Bob from his shelf.
"Bob, I need the wards down now."
"Why don't you just—"
"Because they'll come back up 5 minutes after I've used the disarming spell. I need them down. Get off your bony ass and do it."
"But that will knock them out for at least a week."
"I know. Go do it and hurry. You have my permission to leave the skull for that purpose."
"Aye, aye, oh captain, my captain," Bob said sourly.
A small cloud of orange sparkling light flowed out of the skull's eye sockets and rushed upstairs through the cracks of the edge of the trapdoor. I immediately started dumping things into my bag. I was making a mess doing it, too, but there was no help for that. Less than half a minute later, Bob returned and flowed back into the skull again.
"There are a bunch of guys in suits and uniforms knocking on the door, Harry."
"I know."
"Why?" he asked. "What's going on?"
"Trouble," I said. "What do I have in here that's illegal?"
"Do I look like an attorney? These ain't law books I'm surrounded by."
There was a heavy slam of impact from upstairs. Whoever was up there was trying a ram on the door. Good luck with that, boys. I'd had my door knocked down before. I had installed a heavy metal security door that nothing short of explosives was going to overcome. "Where's the ghost dust?" I asked.
"One shelf over, two up, cigar tin in a brown cardboard box,"
Bob said promptly. "Thanks," I said. "That section of rhino horn?"
"Under the shelf to your left, plastic storage bin."
So it went, with Bob's flawless memory speeding the process. I wound up stuffing the bag full. Then I tore the Paranet map off the wall and added it to the bag and tossed the directory of contact numbers for its members in next to it. The last thing I needed was the FBI deciding that I was the hub of a network of terrorist cells. Bob's skull went in too. I zipped the bag closed, leaving just enough opening for Bob to see out. Last, I took the two swords, at least one of which had been used in murders in the Chicago area, slipped them through some straps on the side of the bag, and then hurriedly duct-taped them into place, just to be sure I wouldn't lose them. Then I drew on my duster and slung the bag strap over my shoulder with a grunt. The thing was heavy. Bangs and bumps continued upstairs. There was a sudden, sharp cracking sound. I winced. The door and its frame might be industrial strength, but the house they were attached to was a wooden antique from the previous turn of the century. It sounded like something had begun to give.
"I told you," Bob said. "You should have found out what was on the other side from here long before now."
"And I told you," I replied, "that the last thing I wanted to do was thin the barrier between my own home and the bloody never-never by going through it and then attracting the attention of whatever hungry boogity-boo was on the other side."
"And you were wrong," Bob said smugly. And I told you so. There was a tremendous crash upstairs, and someone shouted, FBI! At the same time, someone else was shouting, Chicago PD! An instant later, someone shouted a startled curse, and a gun went off. What was that? Screamed a rather high-pitched voice. A cat, said Agent Tilly's voice, dripping with disdain. You opened fire on a freaking cat, and missed. Mister. My heart pounded in my chest. I'd forgotten all about him. But, true to his nature, Mister seemed to have taken care of his own daring escape. There were chuckles from several voices. It isn't funny, snapped the other voice. It was Rudolph, all right. This guy's dangerous. Clear, called a voice from another room, which meant my bedroom and bathroom, since it was the only other room available. Nothing in here. Damn it, Rudolph said. He's here somewhere. Are you sure your men spotted him through the window? They saw someone moving around in here not 5 minutes ago. Doesn't mean it was him. There was a pause, and then Agent Tilly said, Or, gee, maybe he's down in the sub-basement under that trap door over there. You still have men in place at the windows? Rudolph asked. Yes, Tilly said wearily. He raised his voice a bit, as if speaking to someone on the far side of a large room. This place is buttoned up. There's nowhere for him to go. Let's just hope he shows himself and gives himself up quietly. We'll be sure to respect all his rights and everything, and if he cooperates, this could be over pretty quickly. I paused. I had some choices to make. I could still do as Tilly suggested. In the long run, it was obviously the best choice for me. I'd be questioned and cleared by anyone reasonable, that is, not Rudolph. I could even point them at the Duchess's business interests and turn them loose to become a thorn in her side. After that, I would be back to the status quo of wary cooperation with the authorities. But that process would take precious time. A couple of days, at the very least. I didn't have that kind of time. Agent Tilly struck me as someone not entirely unreasonable, but if I approached him now, protesting my innocence, and then vanished, I'd be up for resisting arrest at the very least. Even if everything else in this mess panned out in my favor, that could get me jail time, which I wished to avoid. Besides, there wasn't anything Tilly could do for Maggie. And I had to admit it. I was angry. This was my home, damn it. You don't just break down the door of a man's home on the say-so of a snake like Rudolph. I had plenty of anger already stored up, but hearing those voices in my living room added another large lump to the mound. I doubted my ability to remain polite for very long. So, instead of stopping to talk, I turned to the summoning circle, stepped into it, summoned up my will, and whispered, Aparturum. I waved my staff from left to right, infusing the tool with my will, and reality rolled up along it like a scroll. Soft green light began to emanate from the empty air in front of me in a rectangular area 7 feet tall and half as wide, a doorway between my apartment and the Never Never. I had no idea what was on the other side. The bolts to the trapdoor began to rattle. I heard someone call for a saw. The door wasn't closely fitted. They'd be able to slip a saw blade through the crack and slice those two bolts in seconds. I gathered up my power into a defensive barrier around me, running it through my shield bracelet, and gritted my teeth. My heart pounded against my chest. It was entirely possible that walking through that doorway between worlds would take me to the bottom of a lake of molten lava, or over the edge of a rushing waterfall. There was no way to know until I actually stepped into it.
I told you so, Bob chortled.
An electric engine buzzed above me and then abruptly died. Someone made puzzled sounds. Then a slender steel blade slipped through the crack in the door and someone started cutting through the bolts by hand. I stepped out of the real world and into the Never Never. I was braced for whatever would happen. Freezing cold, searing heat, crushing depth of water, even utter vacuum. The sphere of force around me was airtight and would keep me alive even in some place like outer space, at least for a few moments. I emerged into the Never-Never, my shields at full strength, my blasting rod ready to unleash hell as the invisible sphere of force around me slammed into a rather lovely bed of daisies. My shields mashed them flat. The entire bed, in its little white planter, immediately resembled a pressed flower collection. I looked around slowly, my body tight and ready, my senses focused. I was in a garden. It looked like an Italian number. Only a minority of the shrubs and flowers were planted in raised beds. The others had been laid out to give the impression that they had grown naturally into the space they occupied. Grassy paths wound through the irregularly shaped garden, twisting and turning this way and that. A hummingbird, the size of a silver dollar, darted down and tucked its beak into a particularly bright flower and then vanished again. A bee buzzed by, just a regular old bumblebee, not some giant mutant monster thing. Don't laugh, I've seen them over there. I adjusted the shielding spell to allow air to pass through it and took a suspicious, cautious sniff. It might look like a nice place, but for all I knew, the atmosphere was laced with chlorine gas. It smelled like autumn sunshine, where the days might be balmy, but the nights could carry a heavy nip. Letting the air in meant that sound had an easier time getting past my shield. Birds chirped lazily. Somewhere nearby, there was running water. Bob started tittering.
Look out! Look out for the vicious mega-squirrel, boss,
he said, hardly able to speak clearly.
My gosh, that ficus is about to molest you.
I glowered down at the skull and returned to watching my surroundings for a moment more. Then I carefully lowered the shields. They burned a hell of a lot of energy. If I tried to hold them up for more than a few moments, I'd find myself too weary to function. Nothing happened. It was just a sleepy afternoon in a very pleasant, pretty garden.
Should have seen your face, Bob said, still twitching with muffled laughter. Like you were going to face an angry dragon or something.
Shut up, I told him quietly. This is the Never-Never, and it's way too easy.
Not every place in the spirit world is a nightmare factory, Harry,
Bob scolded me.
It's a universe of balance. For every place of darkness, there is also one of light.
I turned another slow circle, checking for threats, before I took my staff and waved it from left to right again, shutting the gateway back to my laboratory. Then I returned to cautiously scanning the area.
Stars and stones, Harry, Bob said merrily. I guess wearing that gray cloak for so long rubbed off on you. Paranoid much?
I glowered and never stopped scanning. Way too easy. 5 minutes later, nothing had happened. It's difficult to stay properly intimidated and paranoid when there is no evident threat and when the surroundings are so generally peaceful. Okay, I said finally. Maybe you're right. Either way, we need to get moving. Hopefully we can find somewhere one of us recognizes that can get us back to the ways.
You want to leave a trail of breadcrumbs or something?
Bob asked. That's what you're for, I said. Remember how to get back here.
Check, he said. Which way are we going?
There were three paths. One wandered among high grasses and soaring trees. Another was pebbled and ran uphill, with plenty of large rocks figuring in the landscaping. The third had greenish cobblestones and led through a field of nice low flowers that left lots of visibility around us. I went with option three and started down the cobbled path. After 20 or 30 paces, I started to get uneasy. There was no reason for it that I could see. It was pure instinct.
Bob, I asked after a moment, what kind of flowers are these?
Primroses, the skull replied instantly.
I stopped in my tracks. Oh, crap. The earth shook. The ground heaved around my feet, and up along the primrose path ahead of me, the walking stones writhed and lifted up out of the soil. They proved to be the gently rounded crowns of segments of exoskeleton. Said segments belonged to the unthinkably large green centipede that had just begun shaking its way loose from the soil as we spoke. I watched in sickly fascination as the creature lifted its head from the soil 50 feet away from us and turned to look our way. Its mandibles clacked together several times, reminding me of an enormous set of shears. They were large enough to cut me in half at the waist. I looked behind us and saw another 50 or 60 feet of the path ripping free and looked down to see that the walking stone I stood upon was also part of the creature, albeit the last to unplant itself. I fought to keep my balance as the stone ripped free, but I wound up being dumped into a bed of primroses while the enormous centipede's head slithered left and right and rolled toward me at a truly alarming rate. Its enormous eyes glittered brightly, and slime dripped from its hungrily snapping jaws. Its hundreds of legs each dug into the ground to propel its weight forward, their tips like tent stakes biting the earth. It sounded almost like a freaking locomotive. I looked from the centipede down to the skull.
"I told you so!"
I screamed.
"Way too easy!"
Chapter 12. Yeah, this was not what I had in mind when I first got out of bed that morning. The damn thing should have been slow. By every law of physics, by every right, a centipede that big should have been slow. Dinosauric. Elephantine. But this was the never-never. You didn't play by the same rules here. Physics were sort of a guideline, and a very loose and elastic guideline at that. Here, the mind and heart had more sway than the material, and the big guy was fast. That enormous predatory head shot at me like the engine of some psychotic locomotive, its killer jaws spreading wide. Fortunately for me, I was, just barely, faster. I brought forth my left hand, holding it out in a palm-forth gesture of command and denial, a universal pose meaning one thing: stop. Intent was important in this place. As the jaws closed, I brought up my spherical shield to meet it, the energy humming through my bracelet's charms, which burst into shining light as the magic coursing through them shone through the ephemeral substance of mere material metals. The jaws closed with a crunch and a crash, and my bracelet flared even brighter. The shield exploded in more colors and shapes than a company of kaleidoscopes and turned aside the beast's jaws. Its strength, after all, was just one more bit of materially oriented power in an immaterial realm. I brought my right hand out of my coat, holding my blasting rod, and with a shouted word, loosed a sledgehammer of searing power. It dipped down and then curled up an instant before it hit, landing a sorcerous uppercut on what passed for the centipede's chin. It flung the creature's head several yards up, and its entire body rippled in agony. Which, in retrospect, probably shouldn't have caught me quite as off guard as it did. The ground beneath my feet heaved and bucked, and I went flying, my arms whirling in a useless windmill. I landed in a sprawl amid ranks of primroses, which immediately began to move, lashing out with tiny stem tendrils lined with wickedly sharp little thorns. Even as I struggled back to my feet, tearing them away from my wrists and ankles, I noticed that the flowers around me had begun to blush a deep blood red.
"You know what, Harry?"
Bob called.
"I don't think this is a garden at all."
"Genius," I muttered, as the centipede recovered its balance and began reorienting itself to attack. Its body flowed forward, following the motion of its head. I decided that all those legs hitting the earth like post-hole diggers in steady sequence made the giant bug sound less like a locomotive than a big piece of farm equipment churning by. I ran at it, focusing my will beneath me, planted my staff on the earth, and swung my legs up in a pole vaulter's leap. I unleashed my will beneath and behind me as I did, and flew over the thing's back as it continued surging forward. It let out a rumbling sound of displeasure as I went, the head twisting to follow me, forced to slow down enough to allow its own rearmost legs to get out of its way. It bought me only a few seconds. Bigger doesn't mean better, especially in the never-never. 1 second was time enough to turn, focus another beam of fire into a far smaller area, and bring it down like an enormous cutting torch, almost precisely across the middle of the big bug's body. An act of precision magic that I'd learned from Lucio, and which I was not at all confident I could have duplicated in the real world. The beam, no bigger around than a couple of my fingers, sliced the creature in half as neatly and simply as if I'd used a paper cutter the size of a semi-trailer. It shrieked in pain, a brazen, bellowing sound that conveyed, even from such an alien thing, the depth of its physical agony.